What's up, everybody? Welcome into another episode of the Celtics Talk podcast here on the NBC Sports Boston Podcast Network. Coming up today, with all the talk about Kemba Walker and his knee, felt like we had to go backwards and find out like just how concerned should we be. We've got Rick Bonnell of the Charlotte Observer popping on to tell us a little bit about what he sees from Kemba Walker from afar and his experiences covering him. Then later in the program, Cash Cannon, the Celtics Senior Director of Community Engagement, drops by to tell us a little bit about what it's like engaging with kids during this pandemic era and her career and all that she's meant to this Celtics franchise. That's all coming up next. But first, let's listen to Tommy Heinsohn scream. All right, so Celtics fans, panic meter is off the charts right now, and they're worried about whether this is just a little funk with Kemba Walker or something more long-term. Had to call up my guy, Rick Bonnell, Charlotte Observer, just to find out what's like watching from afar. Should Celtics fans be concerned with the way Kemba Walker has performed through his first 10 games this season?
I think his shooting will straighten itself out over a larger sample size, because it always has. I will tell you, Chris, that I think the wider issue going forward, and you and I have talked about this before, is Kemba's own toughness at times is a detriment. There were times here when the Hornets literally had to sit him down and say, look, you need to tell us when you might be hurt enough, you might be in enough pain that you shouldn't be playing. Don't look at this as, you know, an act of honor. You've got to let us know. And again, this is the definition of I'm seven states away. I just see what, you know, you and Tim Bontemps and, you know, Gary Washburn and Amanda Flugrad are tweeting. But what I'm saying is, it seems like Danny has made it very clear that this is their investment and they are going to tell him that he doesn't have a choice but to sit down more. And I think if you're going to ride out the end of this contract, that's important.
So it's funny because like that was the first thing that jumped to my mind watching Kemba in this stretch. We talked in November and you were saying, you know, because we were all wondering like, okay, will Kemba embrace being downshifted and working his way back? Then he popped up in mid-January, which seemed a little bit quicker than some of us expected. And, you know, again, that was a lot of time from between the bubble and mid-January without game activity. But, you know, it was fair to wonder, is he just so eager to get back out there that he's sort of hitting the accelerator? And so I do wonder, watching him go through this, I don't know if you've gotten to see too much of his play the last couple of weeks, but, you know, there are times where he says he feels good physically, but then I watch him get swallowed up going to the basket. I wonder if he's got the same confidence in his moves. You know, how much of his game is going to be predicated on him just trusting that he can be the old Kemba and have that first step and get past defenders? You know, I see things like his free throw frequency is down a tremendous amount. That's the concern to me, that he's not playing with the same sort of aggression and confidence that we've seen in the past.
Chris, do you remember the old Monty Python routine where the knight keeps getting limbs cut off?
Yep.
And he's in denial of it, and he keeps saying, oh, it's just a flesh wound. Kemba is never going to acknowledge that a portion of his body is keeping him from being effective. That's what's beautiful about him. But it's also something, like I said, you know, he's not going to say, hey, listen, I stunk tonight because my knee isn't right. It's not going to happen. The other thing I would mention to you, as somebody who's, you know, spent a long time around him, Kemba has to be a human pinball in order to be effective. One of the things that I thought was interesting along the way here was when Mark Price was an assistant coach here, he had some difficult conversations with Kemba about Kemba understanding that he had to develop a floater. He had to develop a 10-foot pull-up. He had to have some alternative between the three-point line and going all the way to the rim, because Mark, who obviously was a very effective player at pretty much the same dimensions. Mark would continuously tell Kemba, if you continue to try to play the way you're playing, you're going to kill yourself. It's that simple.
So the interesting part up here has been, and now with the development of Jason Tatum and Jaylen Brown, you know, the Celtics want the ball in their hands more. So Kemba's natural inclination over the entirety of his career has been pick and rolls, attacking the basket, pull up threes. He's never really had to be a catch and shoot guy. Now, if you're trying to, you know, get Tatum and Brown more touches and more chances to create, you know, I think he has to sort of gravitate towards that. You know, thinking back to that, those conversations and that floater, did he embrace it, you know, from your view? And can he be modified? You know, can he alter his game? Can he become more of a facilitator at times? Or is it just Kemba's DNA to be that full throttle guy?
Well, first of all, he absolutely took coaching really well from Mark Price, and he's better for it. Mm-hmm. I would also say that if you expect Kemba to become, you know, Mike Conley, it's not a realistic expectation. You know, the Celtics signed him to that huge contract because he was going to be a scoring point guard, because he was going to break down defenses off the dribble, because, you know, he worked and worked and worked four seasons into his career here to go from being a really crappy three-point shooter into a really good three-point shooter. If he's not taking, you know, a minimum of 12 shots a game, then, you know, he's not Kemba anymore. So I would say certainly there's a middle ground there, and Kemba has never been anything like what anyone would call a selfish player. But if you try to undo the whole reason you signed him to the contract, what was the point?
You know, and that's the, I think the part that the Celtics are trying to reconcile with. I don't think they expected, or I think they were hopeful that Jason Tatum and Jaylen Brown would blossom the way they did. And Kemba probably played a big part in that because of the way he's nurtured them and embraced them going to another level. The difficulty is now, you know, maybe a little quicker than they expected, they are the focal points, and it's just going to feel that out. And I think there's a way where this all thrives and works really well, but the early returns, 3-7 in the 10 games that Kemba has played, some of that is competition. You know, we don't want to overreact. They play some really good defenses, Utah, Phoenix, while they were out West. And yet, you know, I do think it's fair to wonder, you know, they've all got to sort of figure this out and do so on the fly. I want to transition because one of the teams I was telling you before we jumped on, I bet if you could check the league pass ratings by geographic location, you would find that the majority of non-North Carolina, maybe some South Carolina based fans watching the Charlotte Hornets is up here in Boston. I know I have. With Terry Rozier, Gordon Hayward, and obviously the addition of LaMelo Ball, this team is super exciting and has Boston connections. So what's it been like watching this team this year? Because Michael Jordan got a lot of scrutiny about the roster he put together and the moves, especially with Boston, but we're finally seeing it sort of come together for Charlotte.
Well, LaMelo Ball has been better quicker than I think anybody who, you know, isn't from Chino Hills, California would anticipate. I will tell you what is really interesting about Ball is how well and quickly he processes information, and, you know, the ratio of fantastic plays versus live ball turnovers has improved continuously. I'm shocked considering, you know, where it was, how many shots he's making. He's really fun to watch. Having said that, the Celtics expatriates here are doing really, really well. I don't know what more Gordon could be doing than what he's doing right now. As a matter of fact, I think considering, you know, what Celtics fans, you know, remember about Gordon, I think you'll find this interesting. I had a one-on-one with general manager Mitch Kupchak recently, and Mitch volunteered to me, it wasn't specifically in reaction to a question, that he was already a little bit concerned that they might be using up Gordon. As he said, you know, I don't think he should be playing 38 minutes. Mm-hmm. And I don't think, you know, there should be an expectation that he scores 38 points all the time. And, you know, Chris, where I think this is interesting, based on what we were just talking about a minute ago, is that, you know, the Hornets made a massive financial decision regarding Gordon that's not unlike the massive financial decision that the Celtics made regarding Kemba. In both cases, I think there's an assumption that the first 2 years of those that contract was going to make or break whether it was a good financial decision, because both those guys have a lot of mileage. Right now, Gordon is playing all-star-like.
Yeah.
The other thing, though, while we're talking about this is, I've told you about this off air, I am just blown away by what a leader, what a flexible, grown-up person Terry Rozier is. I had no idea what to expect because I'd never been around him before. Mm-hmm. There's something really cool about the way that Terry acts in a locker room and the way he rubs off on other people. He's a leader here. And every time I wrote a column last week where I said that no matter how many times they change what he's doing, his only reaction to every situation is, no problem, I got this.
It's amazing. I want to think that a lot of what Gordon and Terry went through in Boston have positioned them well for a little bit of the freedom, a little bit of the leadership that they're now able to show. I think you have to go through some of those rough experiences to fully appreciate when it's your turn to be the focal point again. And so it doesn't surprise me that Gordon is playing as well as he had. You know, it was funny, I think in the preseason, whenever he had that broken finger, I said, oh God, here we go again. And luckily that was such a minor injury and he was able to come right back from it. But he always had the potential. It's just about opportunity. Same thing with Terry Rozier. You know, a lot of Celtics fans were like, yeah, no, not a big loss. But Terry, when he played in that postseason without Kyrie, was phenomenal. And, you know, like I figured he would take a little bit more of a leadership role, but it is impressive to hear how much he's embraced that. Let's start with Terry. You know, what do you think it is about? Is it just that, you know, he's taken ownership, that he's embraced this opportunity? He certainly was, you know, he'd had his young and not immature, but, you know, again, young players just aren't ready for that. And when you have Kyrie in that locker room and now Horford, you're not looked at as a leader. You've mentioned that you marvel at the way he sort of embraced that. Do you think it's just because, in a way, he was brought in and put into that position where he can be sort of a voice of this franchise?
Well, he's certainly closer to the center of the circle than he was ever going to be in Boston.
Yeah.
But also, I'm curious if you agree with this. I think he's a better player down here. He has become one of the league's, you know, a reasonably small circle of best catch and shoot guys in the whole league. You know, I think we need to stop trying to pigeonhole him into a label. He is neither a point guard nor a shooting guard. He's a guard. He does a lot of things well. And maybe it reflects on the fact that the Hornets haven't had a lot of really good defenders, but he's a really good defender on this team. His three-point percentage, man, if he's open, they just go in. I had a personnel scout from another team call me up the other day and ask me about a bunch of different players. And at the end of it, I said, why haven't you asked me about Terry Rozier? Mm-hmm. And he said, I'm curious, why do you bring up his name? And I said, because I want him in my locker room. Mm-hmm. I want him around my team. I want him rubbing off people. And I don't mean this like, you know, old man whose only value is being Udonis Haslam. I mean, I want him in my rotation. He is exactly the sort of team-oriented guy that we don't see enough of in a very me-first league.
It's remarkable to hear you talk about him because, like, when you talk about the catch-and-shoot potential, I think, man, that's the sort of guy the Celtics need around Jaylen and Jason, someone who can, you know, not only handle the ball but go off and shoot those three-pointers. Again, I think we saw glimpses of what Terry could be, but I don't know if it would have ever happened for him in Boston. He had that quick first step. Ainge loved them. Good for Ainge for identifying at a time when in the draft when most people weren't thinking that Terry Rozier would go 16th overall. So it's neat to see him blossom there. And again, he was put into a little bit of a difficult position where Devontae Graham is blossoming and you bring in LaMelo Ball. But as you said, he has embraced all those areas. And I agree. I think Terry's personality, his teammates love them. You know, like, sure, there was a little, that entire 2017-18 team, there was a little bit too much me, and everybody wanted more than there was available. Yeah, I mean, a little. I might be underplaying that just slightly. But, you know, because Terry wanted it because he knew he could handle it. And he got that chance in the postseason and now is really blossoming. What's it been like for Hayward? You know, because I think, you know, everybody said it in terms of there were grumbles from Boston to Charlotte about them spending big money to bring him in. But has he justified the commitment they made to him and the sacrifices they made in order to make that a reality?
A scout from another one of the teams that were pursuing Gordon. I was talking to him after the Hornets acquired Gordon. And I said, look, I know that you did a whole lot of research on this guy. Tell me let me know what the tell is. Let me know what you understand about, if this is working, this is how I can illustrate it. Mm-hmm. The guy made a great point. He said, watch his free throw attempts. That is absolutely Gordon's tell. He said, when he was in Utah, he was utterly fearless going to the rim. He said, after the heinous injury in Boston, he said, this guy said to me, I'm not entirely sure how much of this was about, you know, Gordon's reluctance versus his reduced role. But the guy said to me, his free throw attempts per game went from elite to just plummeting into mediocre. There have been, I'm doing this from memory, Chris, but I think there have now been 6 or 7 games already this season where Gordon has taken 10 or more free throws. His efficiency is off the board, you know, above 50% from the field, above 40% from the line. From three line, yeah. Constantly getting free throw attempts. I am a little surprised, and I'm curious what you think. I didn't know whether he was ready to be the man again, and he very much has been. Does it surprise you that he has been that good in that central role?
No, because and you could tell, like, I don't think it was the main factor, but it was certainly part of the factor. When he was deciding what was next, he wanted to show everybody that, you know, there was always, the suggestion was always, they don't have Utah Gordon in Boston. And I think he said, well, you know, I can't be Utah Gordon necessarily in Boston with the talent that I've got around him. And good for him for, you know, okay, sure, he had his grumbles at times, everybody did, but like embracing being a fourth option. Like, that's tough when you're Gordon Hayward. And I sort of figured the numbers would blossom. I didn't know if it would translate to wins. And now some of that is, again, the Hornets have done a really nice job building this thing out and putting the pieces around them. And, you know, I don't know necessarily what that ultimately means in an East that is better, but they're on the right path. And but just like you say, when I watch Gordon now, what I marvel at is the fearlessness going at the basket, which was severely lacking here. So you think about this offseason, he goes in, this foot thing, he had mentioned it probably around Christmas of last year, that the foot was still bothering him, on the same foot that I believe he had the ankle injury. And we're like, oh my God, is this just going to be lingering, where if it's not the ankle, it's the foot, it's something. But he had to have nerves cut out of there because it's just, like you said, it always felt like he was almost stepping on a pebble all the time. And, you know, I can understand that probably bothers you. But just the freedom, the change of scenery, like the confluence of it all unlocked everything for Gordon Hayward and the ability to be, again, Utah Gordon. Ironically, the boss perspective on it now is Celtics are sitting here quarter of the way through the season. Everyone's like, man, they need another wing who's tall, who has versatility, who can make defense a priority. And we're all sitting here and saying, man, that was probably Gordon Hayward. And, you know, the Celtics tried, like they certainly tried to get him back. But ultimately, I think Gordon needed that change of scenery. And, you know, it all lined up really well. I don't know if he would even be doing this in Indiana necessarily with Sabonis out there. It just really seems like this was a really good fit for him. And credit to him for being able to see that. Like, it's easy to say, yeah, he just, of course, he went for the money. But he found himself a really good situation. I am curious whether he'll muscle his way into that, to that All-Star nod.
You know, Ron Norred, who I know used to work with the Celtics, obviously has a unique perspective, having been Gordon's teammate in Butler and now an assistant coach on the team where he plays. I had a long talk with Ron before the season started, and I said, what do you understand about Gordon that I don't? And he put it so well. He said, you need to remember that Gordon was an engineering major. You need to remember that he said, Gordon can shoot the ball 20 times or pass the ball 20 times. And the only thing you know is that every single time he sized up what he saw and he made the right decision. He said, don't think of Gordon as a scorer. Don't think of him as a facilitator. Think of him as a decision maker. He said he has an uncanny ability to decide what the right thing to do in that particular situation is. And that's exactly how it's played out here.
And the other thing is and I think people know this, but sometimes it's hard when you're not a focal point to notice it, but he's ruthlessly competitive. We were in Indianapolis right before the pandemic. We met with a bunch of his high school friends, stuff for this Gordon Hayward day we were planning. And they were telling me about how, like, they would get together on New Year's Eve with all the families and they would pair up like a kid and an adult, and Gordon would be losing these like simple games, pool or ping pong or whatever. And he would be cussing out the mother of one of his friends because she wasn't carrying her weight in the game. And so I just think, you know, getting injected into a situation where he's been able to show it, like, again, he's motivated not just for team wins, but to prove probably to himself, probably to everybody else, what he could be. And it's cool to see. Again, I think Celtics fans are sitting here watching what's going on down there and thinking, man, they had two really good players and it's good to see them have success. I'll finish it here. What do you think is the ceiling for this Hornets team? You know, we look at the East and the top fours and five, six seeds are tough. Toronto's finally starting to surge. You've got to figure Miami's going to make a run at some point. What do you think this team is capable of?
I think ceiling and what it's capable of might be two different things. Mm. Ceiling is getting to the sixth seed, avoiding having to be in the play-in tournament. But Chris, this team hasn't made the playoffs in 4 years. So what I'm saying is here's what would be really important for them going forward. Gordon and Terry are basically the only players in this rotation who have any playoff experience. Yeah. Just being, you know, you and I understand how different playoff basketball is from regular season basketball. Most of these guys haven't experienced that at all. Getting into a situation with those kind of stakes, even if it's just a play-in game, would be really good for these young guys. If they are somewhere between the 7th and 10th team in the East, they have taken a step. You can call it a small step, but it's a crucial step. If they manage to get up to 6, that's house money.
Nice. Well, and that's fascinating because when you haven't been there for a while, there is a value in just getting there. Celtics balance that. You know, we talk about it all the time with the Magic, right? Like the Magic, I don't know what they're doing. You know, they probably need a reboot. But for Charlotte, when you haven't been there, when you finally have your pieces starting to come into place, there's a value in just getting there, getting those young guys that experience, and then hoping that launches you in the future. Like I said, every chance I get, whenever the Hornets, if I can pull up a game now, I love watching it. I mean, I have to bust out my 1994 Charlotte Hornets starter jacket. And just because, like, when I was a kid, they were my favorite team because of the colors and LJ and Alonzo. It's nice to have them back in the mix. Actually, you know what? I want to ask you one more thing. How crazy is it that Nick Batum is like third in minutes for the Clippers? When the Celtics played them last week, I was blown away by how much they're using him out there.
Well, I would argue that that is a classic example of fans misconstruing overpaid with useless.
True.
Nick is a binder. He's a facilitator. He's a ball mover. He was never going to be the guy here, no matter whether he was getting paid to be the guy here. You put him in a situation like when he's playing with talent like the Clippers, and he's going to make other people better. It's not a surprise in that regard.
Well, like I said, Rick, you've got a lot of eyes on your stuff from up here. I'm checking in because I'm fascinated by this team. It's weird that we don't have a game with the Hornets until the second half of the season, but we'll get to see a few times, right? Like, we got to have a couple, at least two or three games in that mix. I think it'll be a lot of fun to see Gordon Hayward, Terry Rozier, and the reunions with their former Boston teammates. And be ready, because I'm going to probably bug you again to hop on.
I'm really desperate for lobster and clams, so I hope we get to start traveling again.
Let's get this vaccine and everybody. Let's get you back up here. I'm eager to get back down to Charlotte. My mom is down in South Carolina. She's probably a Hornets fan now too. I need to get and say hello and visit there. So let's hope that we're in a better spot when these next games come up.
Well, thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
All right, Rick Bonnell, Charlotte Observer. Go check out his work. Check out all those Hornets stuff. All right, thanks to my guy, Rick. I feel like we call him every week. The Celtics and Hornets are just forever intertwined. I really enjoy getting his perspective, whether it's on Kemba or Gordon Hayward, all that. It's fun to watch the Hornets from afar. Want to transition a little bit. It's Black History Month. All this month, we are celebrating role models in our community. And I want to put the spotlight on Cash Cannon, the Celtics Senior Director of Community Engagement. Just relentless in her work in the community. And just, I want to take you inside her job, what she does, engaging with kids, laying the foundation for them to embrace both the sport of basketball and becoming leaders in this community. Here's our interview with Cash Cannon. One of the things I miss most about being out at the Auerbach Center, because we haven't been there in over a year now, is not only seeing the players and all that, but seeing all the community stuff that this team does, and chief among them is the Senior Director of Community Engagement, Cash Cannon. Welcome to the Celtics Talk Podcast. How are you, Cash?
Thank you for having me. I'm good, just trying to survive and thrive in this new environment, but how are you doing?
I'm good, but people don't see a lot, but pretty much every day that we're out there at the practice facility, once the players clear out, you guys are usually doing some sort of event. Like, how hard has it been in this pandemic not to be able to interact as much maybe as you've been able to in the past?
Yeah, I mean, it's been kind of tough, but, with the work we do, we really just wanted to figure out how we can virtually move the needle. So like you said, like we're used to having access to the practice facility and the Auerbach, the TD Garden and the players. And so we really had to be creative, think outside the box and figure out how we can still address the needs that we see in the community and the needs that we want to focus on when it comes to equity. But we just had to virtualize everything and figure out how do we continue to impact our youth, our community with the resources we have just through a computer.
And so what's that like? Do you have like hundreds of kids on Zoom? Like, how are you teaching? Like, how have you had to modify your style? Like, what's that like?
Yeah, so we are running virtual programs, virtual clinics with our youth basketball department with Sam Taub as the director. He's done an incredible job just having kids on, making sure they're equipped and literally teaching through the computer. So obviously nothing replaces that in-person intimate component of teaching, being an educator, but everything is through the computer. So we have kids on, we give them a Zoom link, they log on, and we just interact virtually. Same thing with all of our community programs. For some of the programs, we're actually sending out, fit kits, jump ropes, different things that our youth can use to become better and to exercise and work out. So again, trying to be creative in all the work that we're still doing out here.
I can barely get my kids to do remote school and get their papers. Because I can't imagine sending jump ropes. Like, computers would be flying in every direction. There'd be damage everywhere. I want to rewind and just tell me, take me back to your introduction to basketball. Like, what got you involved with the sport as a kid and how did it blossom from there?
Yeah, seems like it was forever ago. So I started playing when I was 9. It was kind of on accident. I was getting on my grandmother's nerves. She was watching me at the time. And so she was like, look, I gotta get this girl out the house. So she walked me down to the local rec center and she said, go play. And so I picked up the basketball, made some new friends, and I really fell in love with the game ever since then. And then my dad played a big role in really teaching me the game and taking the time to wake me up at 5 o'clock in the morning and take me down the street and to go shoot some free throws. And of course I hated it at the time, but it paid off. And so, I just had a love for the game. My dad really supported me. I you know, tons of weekends taking me to AAU tournaments and different showcases. And so, you know, I was good at the game. I loved it. I had a passion for it, and it paid off. I was able to earn a scholarship to Northeastern, played there for 5 years. I sat out 1 year, so I was there for 5 years. And yeah, just been in love with the game ever since. And I love basically the power of the sport and what it can do for you and what it has done for me and everyone else on and off the court. So has really played a huge role in my life.
So who were your role models growing up? Were there people that you gravitated towards that sort of laid that foundation for what you wanted to do with your career?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, I had a ton of role models because I could literally, you know, watch a game. I remember watching Candace Parker when she was at Tennessee, and she became my role model. I just wanted to watch her. I wanted to emulate things that she did. Same thing with Kobe Bryant. I was a huge Kobe Bryant fan. I loved the way he played the game. I loved his mental fortitude and his toughness. But in my everyday life, I should say, you know, there's been different teachers. I had a high school coach, Doug Haynes, when I went to Bayview in Rhode Island. He played a huge role in my development. My mom, my parents, I have a wonderful support system in my family, my aunts and my cousins and my grandmother. So I've been really fortunate to have just, you know, a number of role models in my life that have really supported me, guided me, and been there for me along the way.
Well, that's where I wanted to transition it to, because what's it like now? For people don't know, there's this whole group of kids that, like, Cash is the face of Celtics community stuff. Like, what's it like to hear them now say that you're a role model to them?
It means a lot. And it's part of the reason why I do what I do. And I feel like it's my purpose in life and my passion in life to just continue that cycle of impact and be there for someone who may need someone at the time. And so, you know, when I first was offered this position, I was unsure because I wasn't familiar with the Celtics organization in the way I am now, and I wasn't sure if it was going to be surface level work. And so I come from a nonprofit where I was on the ground every day, really interacting with the community and the kids. And so that's what I wanted to continue to do. But, you know, I did my research. I talked to Dave Hoffman, who's just incredible. And he assured me that it is not surface level work. We're not going to schools, putting green t-shirts on kids and telling them to smile. It's actually addressing needs at the root cause. And so, you know, as I mentioned, I was unsure when I was first offered the job, but then I thought, you know, I could be the face of this powerful brand. And what would that do for a young Black girl who sees me or anyone else? And so it was just an opportunity I couldn't pass up, not just for myself and my family, but, you know, for the young girls that are coming up behind me.
So first off, let's rewind. My buddy John Corrales wrote a great feature on you. And in there, Allison Feaster, the Celtics player director of player development, had a great quote. I just want to read it. There are not a lot of faces that look like hers, ours in professional basketball. And she went on to say, it's very important to socialize as early as we can, that the keepers and the holders of knowledge and expertise are not always a homogenous group of people. The fact that she is leading those groups of early learners, that really is a culture building piece. What did that mean to you to hear? Like, because I know Allison, again, we talk about role models, like seeing her in that position for the Celtics, what does that mean to know that you're impacting people that way?
It meant a lot. You know, when I first read that article, I was just blown away. And I literally took that quote from Allison, and it's literally framed here in my house. It's Allison's birthday today, by the way. So shout out to Allison Feaster. Happy birthday to her. But it means a lot because she is a role model to me. Having Allison at the Celtics organization not only helped me, but other women in the organization who look like me. And she's just been incredible taking us under her wing. And just seeing her in this senior leadership position, it means a lot. And it's really inspiring, to say the least. So yeah, it was really humbling to hear that from her. She's been incredible. Like I said, she's a huge mentor, and she's really great at elevating all of us, elevating other women who look like her, and really just blazing a path that we're, you know, excited to follow.
How important is that to when you interact with the kids, to like let them know that that's possible, that there are no boundaries on what any of us can achieve?
it's really important. There's a lot of kids who don't see people who look like them in positions of power and positions of leadership, and representation does matter in a lot of cases. And so it's important to send them that message and to cultivate truly genuine and authentic relationships with our young people, because they don't care what you know until they know that you care, right? And so we want to really make sure we emphasize that message. And when we have them at our clinics and we have them participating in our programs, you know, we just want to interact with them, like I said, in an authentic way, and make sure that they know we're here for them. We're not here just to run a program, but, you know, we just try and emphasize the true point of what we're doing, and that's to just grow them as leaders and as people, and be there to support them in anything that they want to do.
You won a Coach of the Year effort for running a basketball enrichment program that focused on the holistic development of inner city females. You know, take me through that program. What was it about? What were the goals of the program? What was it like to get rewarded for that opportunity?
Yeah, that was fun. The whole reward process is really fun. But Shooting Touch is the organization that I was working for at the time. They're incredible. They're still doing incredible work. They're currently run by Lindsay Kittredge and Ben Bowie, just doing incredible work in the community still. And so I was working for them, running a program. At the time, it was called G3, which stood for Getting Girls in the Game. And it was a basketball enrichment program. And I believe that I was rewarded and recognized for those efforts, because the point wasn't to get girls to play basketball and to love basketball. The point was to use basketball and use sport as the bait, right, to reel them in. And then once we have them in the gym, we teach them all these other things that could help them in life. And so it was a really robust and holistic approach to developing our young girls. And so we learned, you know, on the court, we did train and we were getting better, but then we were also talking about confidence and self-esteem and empowerment and different career fields and all of that good stuff. And so we really just wanted to provide a program that served all aspects and components of a young person in their life and what they wanted to do.
You mentioned you had some hesitation about first taking the job. What's it been like, especially the last, you know, since the start of the pandemic, to watch the way the Celtics have responded in the social justice movement, the way the players have? How proud of you to be part of that organization?
I'm really proud to be a part of Boston Celtics. When I was first offered the job, and then I took the job, I accepted the job, Dave Hoffman, he had a conversation with me, because he has a similar background coming from a nonprofit. And so he understood the adjustment that you have to make going from working for a nonprofit to working for a business, but still doing the same work. And so he always joked with me, this is not a social justice organization, so we have to keep that in mind, but we can still move the needle and make an impact, but still have business priorities as well. And so I joke with him now that, because of all the injustices and everything that's come to the limelight in the past year or so, even though it's been going on for hundreds of years, we started the Boston Celtics United Initiative as an organization. So from ownership to front office staff, we're all working on this initiative towards addressing social injustices and racial injustices and social inequities. And so I'm really proud of the work that we're doing. And I joke with Dave that we are now a social justice organization, and I'm really proud of that. And so, you know, the work that we're doing there is really intentional. We, as an organization, just did a ton of information gathering, met with community leaders and experts, and really tried to figure out and hone in on what are the major systemic issues that are plaguing us right now, and how do we as an organization use our resources and our assets and our brand and platform to address these inequities at the root level. And so it's great work being done across the board throughout the entire organization, and I'm really proud to be a part of it.
Yeah, it's really cool to see. Because again, you know, we see it at the level with the players, but I just know it's touching every corner of this organization and everyone is involved. It's really neat to see. Some of these events get wild. I wanted to ask you about your favorite memories from, and I know one of them. So was there some backboard chattering going on at at an event back in the day?
Yeah, it was my second event that I ever emceed. And so there's, you know, 1,000 people, kids, adults, principals, whoever, we're all in the gym. And it was a culminating event. So we were celebrating the end of a program. And so Ray Butler, who's no longer with us, he was a part of our dunk team, but he's doing some other things with his talents. But we always end with a dunk show with Lucky and the dunk team. And so, you know, I'm on the mic and I'm like, all right, this is the last dunk. It's going to be wild. Ray, what do you have for us? And, you know, he gets his little running start. He speeds through the gym. All the kids are going crazy. He jumps on the trampoline, does like a double front flip. It was incredible. And he yams it. He slams the ball into the hoop and the entire backboard shattered. All the kids were screaming. It was my second event that I had ever MC. So I just remember yelling into the mic like, oh my, it was chaos. Nobody got hurt. Ray had a couple of scratches. He did go to the hospital, but he's fine. He was fine. The school was kind enough to give him the hoop as a keepsake. Yeah, they were nice enough to do that. We fixed their backboard. We got them a new hoop. And so it was all good after that. But yeah, that was exciting and super memorable.
Well, actually, you need to make it part of the routine now. So like every event you go to, someone has to pull down a hoop, and that's how you give a new basketball goal. Like that'll be the symbolic tearing it down. I like the joke, like you go to a lot of these events and of course, you know, they're all a little bit different, but it's always great. The kids are just, they marvel at everything. And it's great to see their faces light up. I can't even imagine if someone tore down a backboard because they're excited just seeing like a player or you guys walk in. That had to be wild. What's on the docket? Like, how are you able to continue to doing this work in this crazy pandemic? And like, you know, are you excited about the potential? Like when will you be able to get back out there and interact with the kids?
Yeah. As of right now, you know, we're just, rolling with whatever, we're able to do, depending on, you know, the vaccine and work protocols. And so for now, we're still running virtual programming. We're in the thick of it. We're running, you know, Read to Achieve and Fit to Win and Fit for a Cause. So all of our programs are up and running right now. And again, you know, we're just still trying to use our resources and our assets to excite the kids and get them motivated. And so we'll have, you know, Jason Tatum and Grant Williams hop on a Zoom and talk to some kids and get them excited. Because if I'm on the Zoom with the kids, they're not that excited. Trust me, you know, they're just
I don't know about that.
You know, if I walk into school and I'm like, I need everyone to read for 30 minutes a day, they're going to be like, yeah, okay, whatever. But if Jason Tatum comes in and he's like, all right, I need you to, they're like, okay, which book? When do I start reading? Are we going to read? So, you know, we just try and use that platform and the voices of the players because they deserve it. They've earned it. They're incredible people with such a big platform. And we really try and use that to incentivize our kids to, you know, make healthy choices.
I get this question a lot. It's like, how can schools, how can kids that, you know, want to get involved in these programs, like what's the entry level for them? Where can they get involved with y'all?
Yeah, that's a good question. So a lot of our programs, we have targeted audiences. So for example, for one of our programs, Fit to Win, we reach out to YMCAs to engage their kids. And so for Fit to Win, we're engaging with kids from Hartford to Maine and in the greater Boston area. So a lot of our programs are run in partnership with community organizations, community centers, YMCAs, schools, and things of that sort. Our Junior Celtics Clinic, that's more of an individual sign-up basis. So there's a lot of engagement opportunities there as well.
My kids got involved with Junior Celtics, got to go on the court. We still have pictures up. It's an amazing experience. Again, once we're outside this pandemic world, I can't wait to see all those kids back on the court at the Garden. I can't get through a whole interview without bringing up Northeastern. It's very rare that I have another Husky in the co-pilot chair. What do you miss most about Northeastern? And why is it Chicken Loose? And is Chicken Loose even still a thing now? Like, I think it's gone, right?
It's gone now. Chicken Loop. Yeah, I know. They were pandemic. Selling like keepsakes and everything. Like it's a huge deal. I know, huge deal that Chicken Loop closed down. But I miss Chicken Loop sandwiches for sure. So that's one thing I miss. But no, you know, I truly miss my teammates. It was such a built-in family, right? You got there and you had 12, 13 sisters just there waiting for you. So I definitely miss just hanging out with my teammates. A lot of the a lot of the memories that I have and the best part of my experience at Northeastern was with my teammates off of the court, actually, just the relationships we had, the things we did together. So I really miss that. But of course, I miss playing, you know, the competitiveness. Practice, not so much. Practice was tough, really tough. But, you know, I miss traveling and the games and the excitement and the camaraderie and all of that. So, yeah, miss that for sure.
Do you ever get Hoff and all the gang out on the court and you know, really show off your abilities against them?
You know what? We've had a couple of staff pickups. Dave has yet to come, but he's probably just got too busy stretching or something like that. But yeah, we've had a couple of staff pickups. That's one thing I miss as well. Hopefully we can get back to that after the pandemic. But yeah, we got some employees who have some skill for sure.
Yeah, like, look, the media game is not no skill whatsoever. So the talent is all on that side of the fence. I know Northeastern misses your 3-point shooting. I want to end on this. What's it like having the coolest name ever? I know, I mean, it's not like you had to modify it a whole lot to get the cash, but how cool is it to have a name like that?
It's pretty cool. I think it might help me in some way. You know, some people might want to talk to me just because my name is Cass Cannon. They're like, whose name is Cass Cannon? So yeah, my full name is Kasheya Cannon. But when I was in high school, I started to really find my rhythm when it came to shooting. And so it kind of made sense. And someone, I think the first person to ever call me Cash, her name was Saheed, when I played at Classical High School in Providence. But it stuck from there. She called me Cash because she said my shot was Cash. And then it stuck with me throughout my career. And it's, you know, it is cool. There's a lot, you know, there's a lot of different jokes that I get with it. But yeah, it served me well for sure.
When you can back it up, when you are raining 3-pointers at Northeastern, like, yeah, you are definitely Cash. Yeah, you don't need another nickname. I sit here, I try to make up nicknames for everybody. People get mad at me when we're trying to nickname Peyton Pritchard and all this, but like, some people just just entry level. You just get it. Well, seriously, like, it's amazing the work you guys do. Every day that I'm there, I marvel at the hours you all put in and the impact you have on the community. Thank you for all you do.
Of course, it's my pleasure. Thank you for having me, and it's been a pleasure talking to you.